Good morning. This is Focus 580, our morning telephone talk show. My name is Jack Brighton, filling in for David Inge. Glad you could listen today. During this hour of Focus 580, we'll be talking about perceptions in Islamic societies of the events of September 11th and the subsequent war on terrorism. We have as our guests three scholars who have connections and insight via their professions, linguistic abilities, and background into the news media and public dialogue in various nations in the Middle East, Africa, and Asia. We want to emphasize that they are not here to represent or speak for anyone in these nations. They are simply here to share with us what they have gleaned from paying attention to what is being said in these areas about the issues. So if you hear anything disturbing during this hour, please don't pin it on our guests. They are only passing on to us what they know other people are saying. Our guests are Abbas Ben-Mamoun. He's professor of linguistics and acting director of the South Asia and Middle Eastern Studies Program of the University of Illinois. He's originally from Morocco. Marilyn Booth, an independent scholar and translator. She speaks and reads Arabic and French as well as English. And Hadi Isfahani, professor of economics here at the University of Illinois, originally from Iran. They're here to talk about what they perceive of that dialogue in various places around the world. And as we talk with them, you are welcome to join the conversation. All you have to do is call us around Champaign-Urbana at 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. If you match the letters with the numbers, that's what you get. We also have a toll-free line anywhere you hear us around Illinois, Indiana, parts of the other states where our signal reaches, via the internet anywhere in the U.S., 800-222-9455. Again, around Champaign-Urbana, you can join us at 333-WILL. Toll-free elsewhere, 800-222-WILL. To the three of you, good morning.
Good morning.
Thanks for being here.
Thank you.
You have each been observing the reaction in the press and other places in certain Islamic nations and staying in touch with people and so forth. And maybe we can just, you know, start by asking what was the initial reaction to the September 11th attacks on the World Trade Center and the Pentagon? Maybe we'll just go around the table here and start with Abbas Ben-Mamoun.
Well, first, it's important to emphasize that, in fact, we are dealing here with the very diverse societies. So we are going to get a whole spectrum of point of view and opinions about what happened there on September 11th and afterwards. As far as the initial reaction, it was in the beginning kind of disbelief that, in fact, you know, Muslim groups could do this, that, in fact, they could, you know, organize this and stage it and they carry it out. But then afterwards, it became obvious that, in fact, these were really Muslim individuals who carried this attack.
Uh-huh.
So, go ahead.
Well, I was going to say, you know, in various places, I haven't been in touch as you have with a lot of these places that, you know, where this dialogue is occurring. I think that there's probably a lot of conflicted opinion about the United States.
That's correct. There are various points of view there.
Yeah.
And so you get, you know, conservatives and liberals. There are those who want to establish good relations with the West, and there are those who want to really to have more independent identity that is quite well demarcated from the West. So you get all these diverse points of view. And, of course, the reaction to September 11th is going to be colored by that debate as well.
But in general, would you say that people were, use the word disbelief, that this would be done, by Islamic people?
Yeah, that's correct, because you know, when you look at the history of terrorism, whether it's in the Middle East or in Europe, where it has been, there was nothing at this scale. That, in fact, the scale of the attacks was just the enormity of it, and the horror was just unbelievable. So there was this reaction that, in fact, this probably could not be, you know, a group that originates from the area.
Hadi Isfahani, what would you say in answer to that?
I think a lot of things that Abbas mentioned were also representative of what happened in Iran, though probably there was a more uniform sense of sympathy for the victims of the event in Iran. There was, in fact, a spontaneous demonstration in Tehran showing sympathy and vigil at night with candles, showing sympathy for the victims. And also there was a sort of widespread condemnation of the events, both within the government and outside. So There was more uniform, probably, reaction in Iran. But Abbas, of course, is not talking about one country. It's talking about a lot of countries in North Africa.
Yeah, I'm curious about Iran. You mentioned that both the government and the people reacting spontaneously in sympathy. To what extent, you know, would the government make a statement or, you know, sort of, well, speak out on the issue in Iran via, you know, whatever statements in the press or otherwise?
The elected officials in Iran were, to a large extent, represent the point of views, public point of views, and they were the first who came out and condemned the event and also have been pushing more towards, you know, having a dialogue with the U.S. or getting closer to the U.S. On some issues, especially on Afghanistan and some international issues. The public opinion was such that even the conservatives, who normally one sees them as opposing the U.S., came out and condemned the event, though later on, they, in terms of negotiating with the U.S., they've taken a hard line again.
Okay, now let's turn to Marilyn Booth, independent scholar and translator. And you have been paying attention to the press in Egypt for the most part?
In Egypt, and also a couple of region-wide newspapers that are widely read throughout the region and that are highly regarded for having perhaps more of a degree of freedom and not being quite as close to any one government line. Mm-hmm. I would very much agree with what Hadi and Abbas have said. I think that one indication of the initial disbelief was that throughout the press there were calls for evidence. We've certainly heard this coming from all over the region and all over the world, and in this country too. People have said, well, you know, what evidence do we have, and so forth. And that was very widespread in the Arab press. They said, well, aren't people jumping to conclusions? Remember, you know, previous cases, and we really want to see hard evidence. That has, of course, died down some because it does seem to have become more obvious who has done it. Mm-hmm. I think, although maybe we still haven't gotten a lot of hard evidence, but certainly that was a very, very dominant theme in the press early on. There was definitely a lot of sympathy and a lot of horror at this happening. The official line in Egypt also, as well as expressing sympathy, was one of saying, well, you know, we have been experiencing terrorism for quite some time, and not to say, well, now you guys understand, but to sort of say, you haven't been paying enough attention to what we've been saying. I mean, this has been very much President Mubarak's line on that as well, that you could have been benefiting more from some of our expertise. And he, for quite some time, has been calling for an international conference on terrorism and, of course, has said this several times since the events of September 11th.
So there's concern there that the United States did not take seriously the possibility of, well, not just an attack on the United States, but the fact that Egypt and other countries have been dealing with this for some time.
I think that it's an emphasis on the United States not taking seriously the possible scale of discontent and of feelings that could lead to this, and being somewhat removed from that and not seeing it as something that really would have effects on the United States and that really everyone in the world ought to be paying attention to. And it's a way also, of course, of emphasizing the causes that people see behind these actions rather than simply the actions themselves.
Okay, now let me ask you, how has the reaction changed since the U.S. began military attacks in Afghanistan? Has the mood or the attitude changed?
I would say very much so. Certainly, I think that there's not a lot of support. I mean, it's very hard to say because, as Abbas said, we're talking about a very, very diverse region.
Sure.
And certainly diverse populations within each country. But I think, by and large, people find it very hard to support the American attacks on Afghanistan. They feel that this is very much targeting an innocent people. And a lot of parallels are made with the situation in Iraq and the continuing unhappiness of people in the region over the sanctions against Iraq. And I think that there's actually been a lot of very, I think, very profound analysis in the press that I've seen, and a lot of soul searching. One friend of mine in Egypt made the comment to me recently that things have really, the level of debate in the press has become much more serious since September 11th. And I think that one of the themes, too, that has come out more and more is the whole question of what is terrorism? How do we define terrorism? And very much a call for as Aisha, I think, said in the last hour, for an international standard that everyone can hold to.
Mm-hmm. Very interesting. Hadi Asfahani, what would you say about that? I mean, how has the reaction changed in the past month or so?
As far as the reaction to the events of September 11th, that hasn't changed. It's there. Since the war on Afghanistan began, the attitude has changed in the way that people cannot find this approach acceptable. I'm talking about the general feeling one gets from interviews, from talking to friends, etc., that they think that the war is not conducted in as precise manner as being advertised, and also other avenues have not been explored, possibilities, and not enough planning to think about what comes next, where this war is going, etc. In fact, if anything, there's some suspicion that the war is going to be used for the U.S. to establish presence in Afghanistan.
Yes. Yeah.
And to open up make it easier for the U.S. to have control and access to Central Asia through Pakistan and Afghanistan. And that has left a very uneasy feeling among Iranians because they feel that this is going to be used to impose increased sanctions on them, cut off relations with Central Asia, between Iran and Central Asia, etc. And they are very uncomfortable about the potential outcomes. And there's a feeling that here in the U.S., there's a feeling that, you know, we're bombing Afghanistan to get at the terrorists. And it's right to do that, and, you know, the civilian casualties are inevitable because we have a good cause. That's fine, but the point of view from that I hear from Iran is that, well, the U.S. may be using this occasion for other purposes. They may not be careful enough with civilians. And there are some examples from the past and examples arising right now that makes one question whether this is enough care is being taken, and also the long-term intentions are what they're stated to be. So this makes people very uncomfortable, and the general feeling is that this is not being done, the war is not being conducted in the right way.
Abbas Ben Mamoun, what would you say to that? How has the feeling changed since the U.S. started attacking Afghanistan?
Well, as far as, let's say, North Africa, Morocco, and Algeria, yeah. I mean, again, you get different reactions. There are those who explicitly said that if the United States has been subjected to a vicious attack, and therefore it has the right for self-defense. I mean, that in fact this is an act of self-defense. Uh-huh. This is clear from, let's say, the Algerian government. The president of Algeria was upfront saying that actually, you know, the United States has a right to do what it is doing now. And the reason, I think, is that because Algeria has been going through a civil war.
Right.
The official statistics is that 100,000 people have been killed in the last 10 years mm-hmm. in the civil war. This is still going on. Yes. It's a really vicious war. So there is that, and also there haven't been many demonstrations in the Algerian streets, unlike, you know, some other parts of the Arab world, which is an interesting reaction by itself. Mm-hmm. In the other countries, I mean, you get a kind of like implicit endorsement from the government that for the United States action, but they also emphasize that, in fact, we should minimize, you know, civilian casualties, that, in fact, the war should not extend into Ramadan mm-hmm. and things like that. There have been also debates about other issues. I mean, there is the issue that Marion mentioned, that in fact some kind of soul searching has been going on in the area. And this has been really an interesting thing to see, that in fact column after column, article after article, talking about why, you know, what's going on in Islamic societies that in fact has enabled, you know, some of these groups, I mean, to develop and develop this kind of, tendency to use violence to advance their political goals. There have also been emphasis on the diaspora, you know, Arabs and Muslims in Europe and the United States, and their plight, that what they see as their plight in terms of that in fact they are afraid, they feel that they are being subjected to harassment and things like that. This is also receiving lots of coverage in the Arab media. Mm-hmm. Another issue also that has been discussed, and that is the economic impact on the areas, which has been really enormous. For example, a country like Egypt has seen a huge drop in tourism, 50%.
Yeah.
Morocco, the same thing. These are countries that rely extensively on tourism. It's a main source of their currency, foreign currency, and they are seeing the impact in a big way. And they're also afraid that, in fact, their guest workers in Europe and the United States may not be as welcome, and therefore that's also might impact the economy. So you are getting a whole spectrum of issues.
Yeah. We have a call to talk with, and I promise I'll get right to them, but I just wanted to follow up with one question to Professor Ben Mamoun. You mentioned, in particular, Algeria, where there is ongoing civil war. And, a few years ago, the Islamic political party actually won the election. The government said, no, sorry, you're not going to take over. And so obviously there is a clash there between the secular government and a large percentage of the population that voted for the Islamic political party. I just wonder if there is a sort of a disconnect between the government and, you know, perhaps the majority of Algerian people on some of these issues.
Well, I mean, what the government says is that, you know, the vote for the Islamists in the early 90s was not really a vote for them. It was a protest vote against the government. But, of course, the Islamists are saying otherwise. They're saying, you know, we were going to win the elections, and then they aborted that election. And therefore, this shows that, the government was not serious about democracy and, does not want to engage in fair play. There is some kind of disconnect all over the area. That in fact, you know, because most of these governments are not elected governments, and this is a big issue. I mean, you look at the whole area. I mean, with some few exceptions, and with, for example, Lebanon, which might sound odd, but actually Lebanon is one of the most democratic countries in terms of the freedom of the press, and that in fact the elections are to some extent fair. Morocco, to some extent, you know, is. There is some freedom of the press. There is an opposition now in government. So you get some few countries that are, more open than others. But in the majority of them, I mean, the governments, are not, like, elected. They are not accountable to their people. And in many of them, you have one-party system or no parties at all, like in the Gulf states, many in the Gulf states. So there is that disconnect, of course. And, so I'm not surprised that, in fact, there may be something like that in Algeria as well. Mm-hmm.
Well, we have a call to talk with. Why don't we do that? And we'll welcome others, by the way. We're talking with three University of Illinois scholars here about their perceptions from their readings and conversations with people in various Islamic societies about the war on terrorism, the events of the past month and a half or so. Abbas Ben Mamoun, he's professor of linguistics, Marilyn Booth, independent scholar and translator, and Hadi Esfahani, professor of economics here at the University of Illinois. We have one caller, and others are welcome, 333-9455 around Champaign-Urbana. Elsewhere, 800-222-9455. Let's talk with a listener in Savoy on line number one. Good morning.
Yes, thank you. I wonder if the callers could say something about the long-term impact of America's domestic response to the terrorist attacks. What I have in mind, for example, in Malaysia, I know that in the weeks and months leading up to September 11th, the democratic opposition there seemed to be making very great headway toward getting rid of legislation in the country that allows the government to detain people arbitrarily, allows the government to engage in torture of basically its opponents, and they had launched a campaign to convince the populace that this is something that really is improper and we need to get rid of it. A lot of people were listening, but then after September 11th, the Prime Minister of Malaysia is able to say, see, look, even America is learning from us. They know that, you know, we have, America has passed laws to detain people without judicial review. American FBI is talking about how they might have to torture some of their you know, people that they have in detention to get information from them. American government is putting you know, pressure on the media not to tell the other side of the story, just to tell the official side of the story. So see what's wrong with what we are doing here. We are just doing what every, you know, what has to be done. Can you say something about the countries that you're monitoring, about how America's domestic reaction might have a long-term impact on efforts at democratization in those various countries? And I'll hang up and listen. Thank you.
Thanks for the call.
Well, I would say that I think that that's certainly a concern. And, for instance, in Egypt for a long time, there's been a great deal of concern among human rights groups there, and there and outside, about the government's treatment of prisoners, most of whom in recent years have been Islamist members or alleged members of Islamist groups. And that is a concern. But I think that in some ways this may, in fact, embolden people because, in a sense, it gives them an international platform on which to say, look, these issues of freedom and of human rights and of treatment are international issues. And I think that, in a sense, it contributes also to the debate by allowing people to explore some specific aspects of an issue that I think has been very, very important for a long time, which is the widespread perception in the region that the American government does not actually practice what it preaches. I mean, in fact, that the American government does not actually believe in freedom in quite the same way that it says it does, as evidenced by some of its actions around the globe in past years. And I would say also, as a response to this, and also just to follow up on what Abbas said about the disconnect across the region, I have found when I've been in Egypt and other places in the region that people in general, no matter what their level of education, are very sophisticated politically. And they do not necessarily identify populations with their governments. And this is certainly very much, as Abbas suggested, a product of situations in the region where people are very, very aware that their governments do not necessarily reflect popular opinion and popular vote. But then for the same reason, even though they do know that we have a democratic system, they are very aware of various kinds of inequalities in the United States, both economically and how that affects the political system. And I think that they don't necessarily assume that we always agree with our governments either. And I know that people are always very, very careful to say to me, we're aware that you may have different views than your government has. And I think that this can actually contribute to the increasing amount of debate that I see in the region, at least within the newspapers and so forth.
Following up on what Marilyn said, I think that on the long term, there may be some positives actually coming out as debates increase and intensify. But in the short term, the effect, the color is actually pointing to a very, very important phenomenon. Mm-hmm. And it's very correct that the current trend is to more repression, more restrictions on human rights, etc. For one thing, the U.S. government is actually cozying up to governments that are very repressive because it needs them. An example, government in Uzbekistan, a lot of governments in the Gulf region, etc. And even in a country like Iran, where the U.S. government doesn't have a role, direct role in the, or any role probably these days in the domestic politics, the conservatives are using the occasion to increase repression or oppose any democratization. But so in the short run, there's going to be a lot more pressure, both in terms of anti-terrorism or those who are opposing the U.S. policy in terms of repressing the other side, that you should not be talking to the U.S. or establishing a dialogue with the U.S. inside Iran. So this is going to have a negative impact on democratization in the short run. Longer run, there may be actually other forces at work, both debates within the region, and also U.S. policy might change for in ways in the longer term, in ways that are going to be more supportive of democratization in the region.
Yeah, I mean, I agree with everything that was said. I mean, this is one of the big concerns in the area, namely that, in fact, this might lead to some kind of more repression in the area. But at the same time, there have been also some, discussion about, that, in fact, there is a need to open up the political process. That, in fact, when you close the political space, I mean, you leave a room for underground organizations and movements, I mean, to develop and flourish. Whereas, in fact, if you open up the political space, you may be able to marginalize the extremist groups. So that may have a long-term, they may have a positive impact.
Well, very good. We have several calls waiting. Let's go on and talk with our next listener on line number two in Pana. Good morning.
Hello. I just want to make a few statements, and then you can see my question. But I am a Roman Catholic. I was raised Protestant. And in our religion class, we are teaching the Old Testament this year, and we also went over the basic Christian and Muslim basics of the religion. And my point is, though, that if we could just find a place to moderate. Because all three religions are leading to the same thing, whether it be Yahweh, Allah, or God. And I know I have a Muslim doctor, a very good specialist, wonderful man. He just worked on me recently, and he told me that the Muslims believe that Christ is a great teacher, a great person, and that Mother Mary, since I told him I was Catholic, he said, and we think so much of the great Mother Mary that she's a wonderful person, and I think it's long past time that we moderate and not be quite so one-sided about these things, because it's one world, and I know the great horror of New York and Pennsylvania and Washington is a horror, and it's almost an impossible task to get this straightened out. It's long past time we moderated and began to see the world as a whole, and I'll just hang up and listen to your comment.
Okay. Well, how about that? I think that most people have said, what I'm hearing from around the world is, Christians, Jews, Muslims, all essentially, they're religions of peace. I mean, there's not a doctrine of blowing up buildings, that's not, according to the scriptures of anyone, basically. I mean, we're not here to discuss religion necessarily, but if you want to say anything, you can.
Well, I mean, there is a discussion actually now. I mean, in the Arab press and the Muslim press, that about the danger that this might become a clash of civilizations, and in fact, Islam and the West, and they emphasize that in fact, Islam has been a builder of civilizations. It was a good custodian of Greek heritage in the Middle Ages, and the European Renaissance built on Islamic scholarship.
Absolutely.
And that those things should be emphasized, that these are really a small group that is hijacking Islam, to make a political point, and that Islam has nothing to do with that it is a builder of civilization, and that they give examples from history. For example, during the Inquisition, the Jewish community in Andalusia found a safe haven in Muslim countries, in Morocco and Turkey. Mm-hmm. And you find that all over the Arab and Islamic world, that in fact there was tolerance, and, at some point Islam was a builder of civilization, but there is this this worry now that this, in fact, might be used, what happened on September 11th might be used, I mean, to start some kind of like confrontation between Islam and the West.
This is a very interesting point, and I don't, you know, if anybody wants to respond to that, that's fine. But I mean, there's an analysis that says this war is not between the U.S. and Al Qaeda, or you know, fundamentalist radical, you know, Islamic terrorists, but between the radical fundamentalists and the secular governments of the Islamic nations, who they feel are not true to Islam, and the U.S. is simply their proxy because we supported these governments. Is that too simplistic a view of things, or are people, you know, discuss? What do people say about that?
Well, I think that's definitely definitely an element of it, and I think that, that again, another theme that I've certainly found widespread in my reading recently has been soul-searching on the part of intellectuals and people saying, you know, we have to stand up and we have to take a stand. We have to let people know that because one is a devout Muslim does not at all mean that one has to subscribe to any of these views. And, of course, we've heard that a lot here, and I think that all of these issues very much point to the need for more education and so forth.
Well, you're asking a very good question because one of the observations I have on the development of Islamic fundamentalism in the region is that a lot of the governments in the region have tried to repress their populations, and it's been they found it much easier to suppress secular movements within their countries. Religion is something, well, people have it and they want to practice it, and there's only so much you can repress it. People do it privately, and governments, in order to maintain a minimum level of support within the population, they have not touched that part. What that has done is that it has created a biased environment where some views have had some opportunities to grow because of the associations that have been allowed to function under the name of Islam, and other associations which were not Islamic were very easy to suppress. So that, as a result, you see the fundamentalism come from the Islamic side, although that probably has nothing to do with Islamic teachings, for the simple reason that, you know, people have been living with this religion for years, and also people around the world want to have a good life, live, and, you know, think of themselves as being good citizens of the world. It's not the case that people who believe in one religion or another really think about themselves as somebody who should go out there and destroy the other person. And we've seen, of course, terrorism in around the world. It's Northern Ireland or Colombia or elsewhere. It has nothing to do. I think one of the elements that has led to the growth of Islamic fundamentalism, the way we see it, is the way governments have been repressing their populations. And also, there's some problem with the U.S. policy in the region that has galvanized this opposition in the form of anti-U.S., anti-American feeling.
If I could just add something briefly to that, too, I think that in certain places, and again, I have to speak about Egypt because that's what I know best, it's been some of the groups that define themselves in Islamic terms that have actually been providing a lot of social services. And as a result, and the government, these are social services such as medical, you know, medical and social and, you know, and even sort of rebuilding after the earthquakes in Cairo several years ago and that kind of thing. And so that in a sense, the government has often lost credibility with people, and they've seen, you know, really which groups are able to produce these and sort of have been able to give them a better life. And so I think that that's been also a sort of on-the-ground aspect of this growing conflict or growing standoff perhaps between governments and these other groups.
Very interesting. We have several calls to talk with, and we have just about maybe 10, 15 minutes left. So let's go on and include some more callers. Next up, a listener in Champaign on line number 3. Good morning. You're on Focus 580. Hello?
Yes?
Yes, that's you.
Okay. I would like to add something to this discussion for Mr. Saadi, especially. And Iran, as you know, at this time, there is not only one government. There is a government to government. And we are talking about the government. We are not sure we are talking about what government. Like Mr. Khatami is trying to moderate Iran, But another religion group, they are not the same route. Like, as we know, the religious people who's Mr. Khamenei, who's his name? Mr. Khamenei, Khamenei. And his group, they are paying like $200 million a year just to the group of Hezbollah. Probably the group of Hezbollah is linking to other group. I'm not saying 100% sure, but I would like Mr. Salih point out this one too.
The differences within Iran are certainly very important, and the current events in the region are affecting the way the two groups are relating to each other. But one interesting thing is that on positions on U.S. policy, for example, condemning U.S. attacks on Afghanistan, it's interesting to see that there's a lot more uniformity across politicians in Iran. This goes back to the discussion we had before, that people don't think that the way the war is conducted is the right way, at least from Iranian perspective, and they see some potential problems in the future. So, but definitely the caller is absolutely right that there is differences and tensions have intensified.
There's one issue that has been raised recently, and that's the approach of Ramadan. And I wonder if there's a lot of discussion about that and the fact that the U.S. is essentially, you know, the Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld has basically said, well, that's not going to stop. It's not a consideration for us. Is that likely to be a very sort of inflammatory situation from what you can tell?
I would say that perhaps from my reading, I would say that's not the basic inflammatory issue. The basic inflammatory issue is the American bombing of Afghanistan. And there might be unhappiness at seeing it continue in Ramadan, but there's so much unhappiness about it anyway that I think perhaps that's – I don't know what
– I would share that view that the main issue is the way the war is being conducted. And Ramadan may be used for the – to try to reduce the intensity of bombings, etc., or oppose it, but I don't think that's a major issue in the debates. At least in Iran, there's not much mention of that.
Okay. I mean, looking at it from a larger perspective, it's important to understand that when you see anger or some kind of outrage in the Arab or Islamic world at United States action, let's say in Afghanistan, it is not at the military action per se. But it is at what they see as the inconsistency of U.S. foreign policy. Mm-hmm. That, in fact, you want Iraq to implement all the United Nations resolutions, but you don't set the same standard, let's say, for Israel's occupation for Palestinian land. And that's what inflames the Arab public opinion, that, in fact, here are Arab and Muslim governments, some of them, acquiescing to American military action, but they cannot do anything as far as the Palestinian case is concerned. So this is really what is inflaming the situation. Now, it is important to notice also that, now the United States has also been doing a better job in this case than in the previous cases in terms of trying to explain its side of the story to the Arab and the Islamic world. For example, they went on Al Jazeera, the satellite channel, Rumsfeld, Rice, Powell, Blair, all of these, officials went on the on TV. I mean, trying to explain that in fact this is not a war against Islam, that this is really a war against the Taliban and Al Qaeda, and so this is a different, approach from the United States than from the previous wars. And I think this is the reason probably why you are not seeing the same, let's say, outrage that you saw, let's say, during the Gulf War or before.
Okay. We have just about 10 minutes left during this hour, Focus 580. Let me just reintroduce our guests real quickly. We're talking with Abbas Ben-Mamoun, Professor of Linguistics and Acting Director of the South Asia and Middle Eastern Studies Program here at the University of Illinois, whose voice you just heard. Marilyn Booth, Independent Scholar and Translator, and Hadi Esfahani, Professor of Economics at the University of Illinois. And we're talking about what they can share with us from reading the press, paying attention to the media in various Islamic societies around the world. We're not asking them to give their views, but the views as they see reported elsewhere. And we have a couple callers waiting. Let's go on next to a listener in Urbana on line number one. Good morning.
Hello.
Yes.
I have a question relating more directly to the press, I guess. It seems that perhaps the administration has decided they may not be winning the war of ideas or propaganda war, whichever you care to call it, and that they are going to introduce or establish an information service directed at the Middle East and Islamic world. I wonder how effective you think this will be.
Well, I would resort to the old saying that actions speak louder than words. I don't think people are frankly going to pay that much attention unless they see some real changes in American actions.
I would share Marilyn's view. It's not going to change things much.
I agree.
Well, just quick follow-up. The U.S. has often done similar things. I remember in the case of Cuba, we set up a jamming station so Cuban TV couldn't be viewed by Cubans, and they would hear and see the TV that the U.S. broadcast. And I wonder if people are not stupid. I mean, I think they probably. Okay, well, let's go on. We have another listener waiting on line number two in Urbana. Good morning.
Yeah, I read a article by Arundhati Roy, the author of God of Small Things. She's an Indian. And recently, about a week ago, in The Guardian, and she was very critical of the U.S., saying that the kinds of freedoms we uphold outside our borders are the freedom to dominate, humiliate, and subjugate, and that our real religion is really the free market, nothing else. She says that we know that infinite justice for some means infinite injustice for others, and so on. She also talked about how New Yorkers would feel if the situation were reversed and they were being bombed in pursuit of one small group within our borders, and how unsatisfying the kind of PR that's coming from our people would be. So I'm just wondering, in terms of India, is anybody there willing to speak about what their present reaction to all this is? I understand that they, for example, are worried that our cozying up to Pakistan,
sure,
might mean something in terms of Kashmir, because they see a lot of Pakistanis performing, quote, terrorist, unquote, actions against Kashmir.
I don't know much about the situation in India, but in terms of the last comment, want to just say that Pakistanis think that the Kashmir is theirs now, that they are supporting the U.S. effort, and Indians think that because of their support, Kashmir is theirs, absolutely. And I'm afraid that this is not going to contribute to a more to a calmer place in Kashmir.
Yeah, I think we're going to have to do a separate hour on this very topic, because it is a big one and I think a very important one. So we'll perhaps leave that there for now and come back to it on another occasion. Let me ask you to talk a little bit about a couple of things that I know have been really central to at least the dissatisfaction with the United States among a large number of people that I think perhaps Bin Laden and Al-Qaeda is tapping into. And there, we could probably, come up with a longer list than this, but certainly, the Israeli-Palestinian conflict ongoing and the United States' presence and support of a very undemocratic government in Saudi Arabia, the center, essentially, of the Islamic universe. And, these are debates that were going on long before anyone was saying, the name Osama bin Laden. But to what extent has he sort of, hijacked or taken over as a someone who is key to that debate?
I think hijack is the right word. Mm-hmm. I think the Palestinians were very upset, actually, that he used that as an excuse. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I mean, for his attacks on the United States. Actually, his big gripe is really is with the United States presence in the Gulf, the bases in Saudi Arabia. That is a big issue. As far as democracy is concerned, well, you know, I don't think anybody is really going to support him for that, because, you know, the Taliban regime that we have in Afghanistan, I don't think any Muslim would want to have that kind of regime and would like to live under that kind of regime. Mm-hmm. And so.
Yeah, I think he's certainly taken on symbolic importance, but I think that's more in the region. I think his symbolic importance has increased since the U.S. bombing, because, you know, now he's sort of the hunted, and he's sort of the not quite martyr figure, but, you know, there's an element of that. But I would certainly agree that, you know, people are upset, because this also means that there can be a deflection of attention away from these issues. And, you know, I think whether or not bin Laden cares about the Palestinians, that is a major, major cause around the region. And I think that if the U.S. were really to try to show a, you know, what people in the region would see as a more even-handed policy, that's the kind of action that might well make a difference in terms of people's attitudes towards things at the moment and towards the U.S. government.
Just briefly adding to that, of course, you know, in the region as a whole, one gets the feeling that bin Laden has taken the form of a folk hero for some. But interestingly, in Iran, there's no sympathy for him. In fact, people experiencing some fundamentalism in the past, especially in the government, that's the last thing they want to see. And also being Sunni Muslim, he's not very much favored by the majority Shia Muslims in Iran. So I don't think there's a whole lot of sympathy for him in Iran. In fact, if there's anything, people would like to see Taliban and bin Laden go. And that makes them actually favor to some extent whatever action the United States takes to take care of that.
Yeah, I think if I could just add one thing to that, I think that's certainly very true. And I mean, he has this kind of symbolic status now, but it doesn't really mean that people are sympathetic towards him. And I think that more generally as well, Salman Rushdie had a op-ed piece this morning in the New York Times where he said that this sort of the sort of Islam that the Taliban claims to be practicing is the fastest growing kind of Islam in the region. Well, I don't know if that's true, but what he didn't say, I don't think, was that it's still a very tiny number of people compared to Muslims in the region. And I think most people, you know, in the region just have very little use for the kind of regime that the Taliban has shown itself to be. Mm-hmm.
Well, unfortunately, we're here at about the point we're going to have to stop, and there's much more we could talk about, but I think it's been a good conversation, and hopefully, you know, listeners got something, diversity of views represented by the people in the places we've been talking about, a better understanding. Our guests during this hour have been Abbas Ben Mamoun. He's professor of linguistics, acting director of the South Asia and Middle Eastern Studies Program here at the University of Illinois, Marilyn Booth, independent scholar and translator, and Hadi Esfahani, professor of economics here at the University of Illinois. And to all three of you, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.